Hi, everybody, and welcome to the second class in our Kabbalah Intensive for Tarot Readers. By the way, before we begin anything else, does anybody remember how Kabbalah is spelled in the context of tarot?
Yes, I do.
Let me hear. How do you spell it?
With a Q. Q-A-B-A-L-A-H.
Good for you. Excellent. Okay, I hope everybody remembered that. If you didn't, make a note. Last week, we spent some time looking at the historical matrix that produced the bonding between Tarot and Kabbalah. And you wouldn't be here right now, more than likely, if there were not such a connection. It's very important for Tarot that this connection was made. You got your first taste last week of the specialized vocabulary of concepts and Hebrew words that applies to the Tree of Life, which is the part of Kabbalah, you know, that is most used in the study of Tarot. And you learned the names and the numbers of the tree. And you learned where to put them. At least I hope so. Any of you feel at this point that you remember the whole thing?
I do. Yeah. I do.
Good. Excellent. We have some optimists here. Good. We'll find out in a little while. In this second class, what we're going to do is we're going to start to look at the hidden architecture of the Tree of Life. It looked pretty simple. I mean, when you first look at it, it's just 10 circles on a piece of paper, not too complicated. In fact, it looks so breathtakingly simple, it's almost simple-minded until you begin to learn what goes into it. And you'll find that it turns out not to be so simple at all. But even as complex as it is, and you will see how complex it gets starting this evening, it's also very, very systematic, very, very clear. And it's not at all hard to learn or to remember. Tonight you're going to advance very, very quickly into some pretty deep water, and I think you'll find it actually pretty exciting.
Will we get to learn how to change the world starting from tonight?
Well, actually, in a way, yes. You'll start to learn how to change the world. And of course, the way you begin to learn how to change the world is to begin to learn what the world is made of. And the whole study of Kabbalah is the study of the way the world is made. And you'll see exactly what I'm talking about as we get into this class. But I want to begin this class where we left off in lesson one, which is with a quick review. I just want to make sure that you're fairly grounded in what we've already done, because we're going to be adding a lot to it. And we want to build on as firm a foundation as we can. So right now, if you have any notes, put them all away. And we're going to see what you remember. And if there are things that you've forgotten, if it turns out, you know, that there are things that you've forgotten, write them down. Just so you know what it was, you know, that slipped your mind, and go over them again later on your own. So the first thing I'm going to do is to check some vocabulary and some spelling and some ideas. Adela, do you remember the meaning of the word Kabbalah?
No, I don't.
Anybody?
I
receiving.
Do. To receive.
To receive. To receive or receiving. Excellent. Now, when there's something that I ask you personally and you don't remember it, or if somebody gives an answer and you've forgotten what the answer was and only found out when somebody answered, write that thing down and pay attention to it so that you don't forget, because each of the things that I'm telling you does actually have a reason for being told. Okay, how about the various spellings of Kabbalah? We have three of them, and I would like to know, first of all, what the reason is for there being three spellings. Helena, do you remember? Why do we have three spellings?
Okay, we have Hebrew Kabbalah.
Yep.
Christian.
Uh-huh.
We have magical.
Magical. And the magical is called what? Do you remember?
Kabbalah.
Well, the word magical in this case can be replaced by the word hermetic.
Hermetic.
And hermetic means, Scheherazade, what?
It's the magical practice of the letters.
Yeah, well, actually, hermetic actually comes from somewhere. Do you remember
Hermes.
From Hermes, exactly. From Hermes. Hermes being the lord or the god of magic, the Greek god of magic. I'm telling you this because these are words that you're going to come across frequently, and we're actually undertaking a form of education here, and it would be a good thing.
And well, what did you mean that it can be replaced by?
The word magical is a general term. The word hermetic is an actual specific. It's the name of a particular kind of practice and a particular kind of philosophy, and it is what we apply to this particular branch of Kabbalah. We call it hermetic rather than magical, because magical is a word that gets fuzzy and means other things. So we want to stay specific. You will see the word hermetic Kabbalah referred to in a variety of places. And when you do see it, I'd like you to know what it refers to.
But it's referring to magic in an indirect way? Is that what you're saying?
In a way. The whole field of European symbolic magic actually falls under the heading of hermetic. But there are lots of kinds of magic that aren't hermetic.
I see.
There's
Wasn't
shamanic
there a
magic.
Book called the Hermetica, too, that came out?
Yeah, that's a whole world of things unto itself, and all I want you to do at this point is simply to remember the name. So that's all. So you're right, there is a Hebrew, a Christian, and a Hermetic version of Kabbalah. And Debbie, the Hebrew version of Kabbalah is spelled how?
I think it's with a K, I don't know.
It is with a K. Do you remember the...
K-A-B-A-L-A?
There's
know.
Actually two B's, K-A-B-B. Then A-L-A, and then there's an H on the end. Okay, so everybody who doesn't remember that or didn't remember that, make a note of it.
So only one L.
Only one L.
Okay.
Two B's, one L. Then, let's see, Bobby, the Christian form of it is spelled how?
C-A-B-A-L-A.
Good for you. Good for you. Okay. And then the Hermetic version of it, Gina, is what?
Q-A-B-B. No, Q-A-B-A-L-A-H.
Excellent. Perfect. That's the way it is. Okay, so you have those things, and those things are important to know. They're the absolute rock-bottom beginning of this whole process. Then we have a couple of ideas. We have, before even the ideas, we have the name of those circles that are on the piece of paper. We have the Tree of Life. We know the Tree of Life is that group of circles on the piece of paper. There are 10 of them. But do you remember what we call those circles?
Yes.
Okay.
Sephiroth.
Sephiroth. It's actually not, and this is where...
Sephiroth.
Yeah, it's best if you put the accent on the last syllable. There are two versions, there are two main forms of pronunciation of Hebrew. One of them puts the accent, tends to put the accent on the last syllable of a word. The other one tends to put the accent on the next to the last syllable of the word. In this particular case, we'll use the first version where it's possible. So Sephiroth is probably the best pronunciation. By the way, when it comes to pronouncing things correctly, I should make you aware of the fact that some people think that it's unnecessary. And from a certain perspective, it is. It isn't going to change what you know specifically. But if you go to France and you're trying to speak French and you speak with a horrendous accent, they're not going to like you much. If you're going to speak French, learn to speak French as well as you can. I mean, you may never be perfect. Sometimes people speak a foreign language with an accent all their lives, even if they live in that country. But it's not a bad idea to learn how to speak a language correctly, and this is a language. And you might as well learn to speak it correctly. You'll be honored for it, and it will help, actually. So, the next question is, if Sephiroth is the name of all 10 of these circles, what's the name of one of them? What's the singular? Sephira. I believe that even in the Sephardic pronunciation of Hebrew, where the accent is on the last syllable, that in this particular case, the accent is on the next to the last. Sephira will be is the correct pronunciation, or the best one for the purpose. Gail, do you remember what the three smaller names are that give the meaning to Sephira? There are three words that are based on the same root, and they mean three different things. Do you remember what the words were?
No, I don't.
Do you remember there being those three words?
Yes.
Does the memory of it stimulate your imagination at all? Okay, well, wait. Just be aware of them, and somebody will know it probably. Martha, do you remember?
What did you ask? I'm sorry?
There are three words that are made up of the same root letters that Sephira is made up of, and they add levels of meaning to the word Sephira. Do you remember what those three were?
No, you didn't tell us, Walt.
Oh, yes, I did. Well, I spent a lot of time on it. Okay. Okay, so let me ask for a volunteer then.
Me.
Me. Who's me?
Helena.
Okay, go ahead.
Zephyr.
Well, no. There's one. Remember that there. It's each one of these words is a two-syllable word. So what's the first word?
Zephyr.
No, that's got three letters. Sephira. There's no such thing as Sephira.
Sephir.
Oh, safer. Safer. Yeah. Okay. Safer. What does safer mean?
Book.
It means book or text.
Yes.
And how would you spell that?
In Hebrew?
No, in English.
In English, S-E-H-E-R.
Okay. And
Lynn... Spell that again?
S-E-F as in Frank, E-R.
Okay.
Linda, do you remember what the second word in that group of things is?
No, I do not.
Okay.
I do.
Bobby? Oh, who's I do?
Elena.
Cipher.
Well, actually, cipher is the English word. It's actually, you got the right idea, but the actual word is sefar. S-E-F-A-R. And sefar is the root of the word, the English word cipher. But do you remember what it means or what it's about?
Sure.
What?
I'm reading my notes, number, formulas.
Okay, but I don't want you to read your notes.
Limits,
that's exactly what I don't. I want you to see what you remember.
Yeah, but, that way I'll remember.
I know. Okay, then we have the last one.
So it's number or formula?
It's number. And it actually means, it actually has reference to everything that can be counted and measured and weighed, all things that can be described by formulas.
Science.
Well, science certainly falls under that heading, but a lot of other things besides. Okay, let me see. Gina, do you remember possibly what the third word is?
I do. I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce it correctly. It's Sipur.
Sipur. Excellent. And how do you spell that?
S-I-P-P-H-U-R.
Actually, there's no H in it. It's just a U-R, but that was really close. S as in Sam, I, P as in Frank, P as in Frank, U-R, Sipur. And Sipur means what, approximately?
It means communication or telling.
Absolutely. And the significance of that is that both text and number need to be joined together in some kind of meaningful or significant way. Making significance, making meaning, making sense out of all the data, the information, the knowledge that comes to us from a variety of sources is a function of Sipur. So what we have is text and number and communication. And those three things create the root of the usefulness and meaning of the Sefirot. And you may remember that the 10 Sefirot are connected how to Tarot?
They correspond to the Minor Arcana?
Yes, they correspond, precisely, they correspond to the 10 numbers that make up the Minor Arcana. So when you're talking about text and number and communication and all the things that can be measured, all the qualities, all the quantities, and all the forms of connection between them in the entire universe, and you realize that that is what is involved with the 10 numbers that make up the Minor Arcana of Tarot, you begin to have a bit more respect for what is called minor. It's not really minor at all. But in any case, that is the main thing that I wanted you to get now, just to remember those things. The Hebrew names for the Sefirot we will continuously use, and you will remember them as we go. If you don't remember them already, repetition will certainly do the trick for you. Does anybody have, at this point, any questions or comments about this material before we go any further? Okay. We are now going to get into some very interesting stuff. This is where we begin. Now take out a fresh Tree of Life. Tree of Life diagram with nothing on it but the printed material, the printed circles, the printed Sefirot. Okay. At this point in our study, everything is still a question. Very, very few answers, if any. I want you to look at the Tree of Life. Just look at it. Now this image, these 10 circles arranged in this particular interesting diagram, is part of an answer to the question, what's the shape of the world? That's what you're looking at, the shape of the world according to Kabbalah. The answer that these 10 circles give you is a part of what is called Kabbalah. It's just a part. And it's also the root of all meaning in modern tarot. I say modern tarot because you remember that there was a time when Kabbalah and tarot were not nearly as closely joined, at least as far as we know historically. So for the last 150 years, this has been true and getting truer all the time. But before this question about, what the shape of the world is, there's another question. If, and it's a big if this particular picture is truly what there is, if this is truly what the world is shaped like, where did this come from? Anybody have any ideas at all? How did it arise and why? It's a major, major question. Excuse me. Say that again?
I was thinking it came out of nature.
Well, that's a very interesting issue. Where if it did it come out of nature, you're going to see the place of nature in the scheme of the Tree of Life this very evening. And it actually, the answer to that is actually no. From a Kabbalistic point of view, that is actually not so. What I'm going to show you is the answer begins on the back of the sheet. So turn over the sheet, please. The back of the sheet, yes. Here's this piece of paper. You've got a white piece of paper, and you've got 10 black circles on it in the pattern of the Tree of Life, and on the back of the paper we have what?
Nothing.
Nothing, absolutely. That's the answer I'm looking for. You got nothing.
So the void, okay.
Yeah, you got nothing. Nothing is there. There's a Tree of Life on the other side, and the Tree of Life, like everything else, arises from this blankness. Everything comes from nothing. But the interesting thing is that the back of this sheet of paper, this blank whiteness, is actually not nothing. What it really is a field of potential. It's a blank page. An infinite variety of universes could arise on it. You could draw anything, write anything at all on it. It's totally open. You could actually call this field of potential the very first something. So we still haven't arrived at the nothing because we're still stuck with a question. Where did this something come from? Where did this blank piece of paper come from? Where did this blankness, this white, clean sheet that we're going to write everything on, where did that come from? And the question can be answered in this physical world only by saying that it's indescribable. Nothing cannot be described. It has no attribute. So even this blank piece of paper, this nice 8.5 by 11 white sheet, is something. But just imagine for the moment that we were to perform an act of imagination and daring. Just imagine that we did this act of imagination and daring, and we actually proceeded to describe the indescribable. This, by the way, is precisely what Kabbalah does. And it is, in fact, what every major philosophical, religious, mystical, and spiritual system does. It attempts to describe the indescribable, actually goes ahead and does it. So if you were to imagine that the sheet of paper were to become, as you held it, transparent in your hands, so transparent that even its outlines faded away, but the image remained in your retina. You had a kind of visual memory of it, even though it had ceased to be visible. The potential for potential is actually there, but there's really, now there's nothing there except the memory or the idea or the possibility of possibility. There's an 8.5 by 11 emptiness that will eventually, somehow or another, be filled by a piece of paper. Now, Kabbalah describes this indescribable thing, this indescribable nothing that has no attributes at all, in a very simple and a very elegant way, with a negation that is one negative plus three strokes of a pen and three words. So I'm going to tell you what those are. It's very, very interesting. It's a beautiful little picture. So the first thing that has to be said is, the first thing that Kabbalah says is that before there was something, something was not. Now, the something we can put in quotation marks. Just imagine this word, something, and then say, something was not. There was, not only was there no thing, something just wasn't. There was no something. There is the problem that we know that there, the world exists, so somehow or other, out of this negative, this non-existence, something came, something arose. And how do we manage to accomplish that? So remember, even as you're looking at this blank sheet of white paper, you have to go back in your imagination even one step before the blank, to where the blank doesn't even exist, and try to imagine how this whiteness arose from nothingness. So the very first thing that Kabbalah posits is that before there was something, while no thing existed, while there was no existence. Remember, when you say no thing existed, you're saying that literally there was no existence. There was, in fact, an unruffled expanse of consciousness that has absolutely no attribute. A consciousness without attribute, no description. At this point, there is no white sheet. In fact, there is no God. You can't say that God exists here. Nothing exists, not even divinity. However, in this vast, unruffled expanse of attributeless consciousness, there arises a will to be. How this happens, I couldn't tell you, but it does happen. A will to be arises. And the will to be is in itself a contraction in the expanse of consciousness. Like a wave on a very, very flat ocean. One single wave. And I'm going to show you with a pen stroke what that wave looks like. Of course, it's only an analogy, but it's a very pretty one. What I want you to do is, in the middle of this sheet of paper, or just slightly above the middle, I want you to draw an arc, about maybe 2 inches long, just a little portion of a circle, like the top part of a circle.
On the tree of life?
Nope, on the back, on the blank whiteness. The arc should be, as I said, a very small portion of a circle, but it should be about 2 inches long. This is what we call a wave, a contraction in the ocean of consciousness. And now we're doing it on this white sheet of paper, and we said the white sheet doesn't even exist yet, so we have to imagine that this white sheet of paper is this emptiness. So it's an act of imagination that we're doing here.
Well, this is Martha. You said a wave of contraction where?
In this unruffled, flat expanse of the ocean of consciousness, which doesn't even exist yet. So there's a contraction that says, I want to exist. I will exist. And the very first contraction, which shows as a wave in the middle of this nowhere and nothing, this very first one has a name. We give it a name. So above this arc, I want you to write the word Ain, which is spelled A-I-N, as in Nancy. This is the first contraction. And it means, it's a Hebrew word that means not. It's not even nothing. It's just not. But even not is a big advance over the unruffled state that existed before. But then there comes a second contraction, another wave in the ocean. So what I would like you to do is to draw a concentric arc about a half inch under the first one.
What's concentric?
Concentric means having the same shape. Just draw another arc right under the first one that looks the same as the other one, except it's a half inch lower. And that arc is the second contraction, the second step in the will to be. And we have a name for that one too. It's called Ain, which is the first word, Soph, S-O-P-H. Ain Soph, two words. A-I-N is the first word, and the second word is S as in Sam, O, P as in Peter, H. Ain Soph. And Ain Soph means, essentially, nothing without end. First we had just plain not. Now we have actually contracted and become more specific and become nothing without end. It's an odd thought that the phrase nothing without end should actually be more specific than something else. But then, there is a third contraction. We're getting closer and closer to the point where something will actually come into existence, but nothing has yet. So three consecutive waves of intention happen, and the third wave of intention is a third arc, which you will draw underneath the first two. Again, leave about a half inch of space. And this third arc is made up of three words. The same first two, Ain, Soph, and the third word is Or, and we can spell that A-U-R, Ain, Soph, Or. There are other ways of spelling Or, but we're going to leave it at that because that's a fairly common one for our purposes. Or actually means light in Hebrew. So Ain, Soph, Or could be translated as the light of limitless nothing. Now, this is not the kind of light that you can see with the eye, because there was no eye to see it. Now, here at this point, when the three waves of intention have contracted three times, we've actually...
Can you repeat what the last thing means again?
The last phrase, Ain, Soph, Or, could be translated as the light of limitless nothing.
Thank you.
At this stage of things, there are two ways one could go. There is a very serious, very heavy, very ponderous spirit that says, you know, this is a very serious matter, that God is in the process of becoming, that the world is just about to happen. And it's a very serious, very portentous, very momentous moment. And everybody gets very quiet, and everybody's face gets very long, and we're waiting for the drum roll. There is definitely a spirit like that among people who study Kabbalah. And there is also a more playful spirit. And in the spirit of play, one could say that instead of a long, serious face, this great ocean of consciousness is feeling playful and says, I have been alone all this time. Let me become many. And so he begins the game of becoming many, and it's a great sport. And you could think of what is to come as the sport of consciousness. It's a quite remarkable idea. Not everybody thinks this, and not everybody would accept it. There are some who do. It forms something of a heresy, I suppose, but it's quite a remarkable concept. Let it stand, and feel free to use it if you wish, and you don't have to if you don't. But at this point, whatever the intention is, whatever the will of divinity is, it has approached what you could call the curtain of the indescribable. This is the boundary. The indescribable has now been given a place to be, a curtain, a wall, a place that which on one side is still indescribable, but on the other side, for the very first time, description will happen. So what happens now is that the curtain of the indescribable is pierced, and the energy of the indescribable pours forth as an act of will and willingness, a willingness to be. The white sheet comes into existence as a field of being, and the first Sephira is created, and God exists. God is one, finally. And also, the Tao Ace is just about to be born.